Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. That is www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Welcome to Between the Beltways, a political podcast series from the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Each month, your hosts, Dr. Deepan Chatterjee and Dr. Shreyasi Deb, will explore the races that will shape the central Maryland counties of Howard, Montgomery, and Prince George's in the upcoming midterm elections.
Hello and welcome to the 8th episode of Between the Beltways. This is Dr. Deepan Chatterjee.
Hello, this is Dr. Shreyasi Deb.
And today we have a returning champion, Zach Cohen, who was part of our 6th episode. He is the Senate correspondent for the National Journal, and he helped us analyze some of the electoral races, local electoral races in the 6th episode. So we thought we'd bring him back now that we are so close to the midterms. So welcome, Zach.
Glad to be here.
So my first question to you, Zach, we saw a couple of weeks ago the Republicans put through Brett Kavanaugh in a very contentious confirmation process that involved a background investigation by the FBI into alleged sexual assault allegations. And then, you know, we saw a very rushed FBI investigation, not very wide and very limited in scope. So now that Brett Kavanaugh sits on the Supreme Court as the 9th justice, who do you think this is going to help more in the midterms, the Democrats or the GOP?
It's hard to say. I guess we'll find out sometime next month when the election rolls around, and we'll see how much this is still a top issue for voters. And I do think other issues will probably be on voters' minds, such as health care and the economy, immigration and taxation, and you name it. I find it hard to believe personally that Democrats can be more enthusiastic than they already are. We're seeing that in turnout in some of these congressional and special elections, as well as last year's statewide elections in places like Virginia and New Jersey and even Alabama. And I don't know that that has dissipated at all. So Republicans have more room to grow, so to speak, in terms of enthusiasm. And Republican voters do tend to be particularly energized when it comes to the fate of the Supreme Court. So I do think Republicans do stand a chance to gain a little bit more from the last few weeks than Democrats do.
Okay.
So we are hearing a lot about women reacting to the Kavanaugh confirmation. How is it slicing up in terms of party loyalty and demographics such as age and education? Who are going to carry the advantage of the women vote?
So there is a gender gap on this issue. There was a recent ABC poll that found that men only very narrowly opposed the investigation, 49% to 47%, while women, by contrast, actually supported a congressional probe by 58% to 37% margin. And women are going to be a really important factor in next month's elections. We've seen in some polling that shows that undecided suburban women are sort of the go-to undecided vote in this election, and it's where Democrats think they stand to do particularly well, especially in House elections where these districts are in some of these suburbs. You know, there's always exceptions that prove the rule. I was out in West Virginia a few weeks ago, and there were women coming up to Senator Joe Manchin, the lone Democrat to vote for Justice Kavanaugh, before the vote, saying, "Senator, we really need you to support Justice Kavanaugh." And, you know, three women I saw tell him this. And then a man came up a few minutes later and said, "You have to oppose him because his behavior on the hearing with Dr. Christine Blasey Ford was unacceptable." So it does cuts across partisan and gender lines, I think, from time to time.
That's interesting. And Joe Manchin is the only Democrat who crossed party lines and voted for Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation. So that's interesting that you experienced women asking him to support his confirmation firsthand in West Virginia. This year, women are also running for Congress in record numbers. Do you see any dynamics with that?
Yeah, I've heard a few people refer to us as a pink wave rather than a blue wave, if you will. And women are running for office more often. This is something we saw similarly back in 1992 during the so-called Year of the Woman. This was almost immediately after Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the Supreme Court and after the confrontational Anita Hill hearings. And so you could see not just more women running for office, but more women voting this year. And we'll find out in November. But women are winning their primaries more often, and they stand a pretty good shot of winning a lot of these races, not just in the House, but as well for governor's offices in the Senate, because a lot of this movement from women is coming from Democrats. Most of the Senate races have incumbents in them, and actually a lot of them are women, people like Heidi Heitkamp and Claire McCaskill. So you could see, it could be possible that we'll have an increase in the number of women in Congress next year.
Yeah, and I think, you mentioned the Clarence Thomas hearings. I think the assistant Democratic leader in the Senate, Patty Murray, was, elected to Congress at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was a state rep, and she decided, she was a school teacher, mom, and she decided to run because she didn't like the way that Anita Hill was treated by the pretty much all-male Senate Judiciary Committee. At least you had some women this time around, most of them Democrats, but, you still had actually all of them Democrats.
Yes, the Republicans were all men.
Yeah.
That's right. And Dianne Feinstein, who was the Senate ranking member from California, she similarly ran for Senate for the first time in 1992 because of what she saw from the Anita Hill hearings.
Right. This is pretty significant.
Okay, so my next question to you, looking at this election now, 3 weeks out, very simply, who do you think has the edge in the House and the Senate? We know that Democrats are projected to win anywhere between 30 and 60 seats, looking at different polls, and the Republicans look like favorites to take the Senate. You know, right after the Kavanaugh confirmation, they got a bump in that respect. So who do you think, looking at it like from your perch, atop the expert's chair, and from your research, what does it say, and who do you think is going to win the House and the Senate? I'm putting you on the spot and asking you to look into a crystal ball of sorts.
Right, and I stopped predicting things after the 2016 election, which I think a lot of people have been trying to do as well. Look, I think Democrats are in a pretty good place, not just to gain seats, but to win the House of Representatives, as you said. They could win anywhere between 30 to 60 seats. And that's because not just because there's been increased Democratic enthusiasm, and typically there's a backlash against the president in power, against his party in congressional elections in first midterms. So Republicans do have history against them. But there's also a record number of retirements, not just from sort of rank and file Republicans, but from committee chairs even. It's much easier to flip a seat when it's open. It's a little harder to run against an incumbent, so you could see Democrats pick up a lot of seats. It's really, I think, just a question of the margin. At this point, is it going to be a margin that allows the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party to have a say, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or is it going to be more moderate Democrats that will have a little more sway because it'll be a narrow margin and you'll need them on board? Will people like Conor Lamb and other blue dogs, who also won his first election to Congress this year? Senate's just going to be a very different battleground, in part because of where these elections are taking place, where I think actually Republicans stand to pick up seats in the Senate and grow their majority from the current 51-49 balance that it is now. You have a lot of vulnerable Democrats in places like North Dakota, Missouri, West Virginia, Indiana, and while some of those states are looking more favorable toward Democrats, they would essentially have to run the table and win every election, and a lot of these races are going to be very close, and a lot of polling has been within 1 to 2 points. And in order to pick up seats, Democrats would also need to win in tough states like Nevada and Arizona, Tennessee and Texas. So just based on where the maps are for both the House and the Senate, you could see wildly divergent results, not because voters are voting differently, just because of where these voters are located.
Mm-hmm. So if we for a moment pause and think, given the map and the way it exists right now, that the House goes for the Dems and the Senate goes for the Republicans with a bigger majority and with President Trump in the White House, what do you think would be the prospect for legislation and policy making in the Congress in the next year, in the new Congress?
If you have Democrats take over the House and Republicans maintain control of the Senate, I think probably both bodies would end up doing what they can do unilaterally. You'll have committees that will have subpoena power and judiciary and oversight that could make things very difficult for the Trump administration. There are Democrats talking about, well, we can subpoena tax records, we can investigate Justice Kavanaugh, and that could lead to impeachment proceedings against the justice, or they could even start impeachment proceedings against the president if there's enough of a wing of the Democrats that want to go about doing that. And then the Senate can keep doing what it's doing. Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the majority leader for Republicans, has been shepherding multiple judges, not just two Supreme Court justices, but also judges at the lower levels of the courts at a pretty astounding clip. And he could continue to do that unanimously because the House isn't going to say in judicial nominations. But beyond those two, I'm not sure there's going to be much room for negotiation. You know, it's always possible bipartisan work does come across. It's been known to happen even in these hyperpartisan times. But I think you'll see much of the attention focused on judicial nominations and confirmations in the Senate and investigations and subpoenas in the House.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, so among all the Senate races that you're following and we are following, and among all the close races, especially in the 10 states that Trump won by more than double digits, which ones do you think are the closest right now? Which will really, you know, I think it comes down to really two or three races that we are talking about, which I think is going to determine control of the Senate. So which ones are those, and what do you think about those races?
There's a couple of races. I think it's probably a little more than two or three. I was just out in Nevada last week following around Congresswoman Jackie Rosen, and she's in a tough race with Republican Senator Dean Heller, who's the most vulnerable Republican senator up for re-election. It's the only state that voted for Hillary Clinton, albeit by only 2 points. And I was talking to Democrats and Republicans, and they basically think it's going to be a one, maybe a two-point race in the very end. So Democrats are going to spend a lot of time trying to boost turnout in places like Clark County and from Las Vegas. And Republicans are trying to boost turnout in the more rural parts of the state. We just heard that President Trump is going to go campaign in Elko, which is in a rural part of the state. So that's a base election right there, and that's probably Democrats' best pickup opportunity. But then a lot of the other competitive races are in states that Democrats are defending. I mentioned Senator Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota is facing Republican Kevin Cramer, who's been up in a lot of polling, and I think both Democrats and Republicans see that race sort of falling off the map. I would never count out Senator Heitkamp. She did win her 2012 race by a very narrow margin after being down in polling, and this could be a very good Democratic year. Other races, I would mention Missouri. That's been either tied or within 1 to 2 points for the most part, except for some Republican polling that has shown Attorney General Josh Hawley, the Republican, ahead of the Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. So that is definitely one to watch. Indiana has also been pretty narrow, though I do think that Democrats and Republicans alike tend to think Joe Donnelly, the incumbent Democrat, has an edge over a Republican self-funder named Mike Braun. And then there's been some private Republican polling that shows Montana close. Senator John Tester's up for re-election there, and he's running against a state auditor named Matt Rosendale. And so I think those are some of the races to watch. I think some of the races that maybe aren't as competitive are places like West Virginia, where Joe Manchin has been up in most of the public polling against Republican Attorney General Patrick Morrisey. And other senators that are probably in pretty good shape are people like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, Debbie Stabenow in Michigan. And then I should mention, finally, is Florida, which always has narrow contests. But if we see a really big turnout in places like Miami-Dade, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson will probably win, but he is facing a very stiff challenge from Republican Governor Rick Scott, who has outspent not just Senator Nelson, but also all of his Democratic allies on the airwaves. He's a wealthy man and has raised a lot of money. So that's a competitive race to watch as well.
That is interesting, because some folks, just like the blue wave and the pink wave, some people are also talking about a green wave with record fundraising by the Dems. So you're saying in Florida, Rick Scott has spent way more money than the Democrats. That's very interesting.
That's right. And environmental issues are probably or could have a big impact in this race. The state has been battling a pretty severe algae problem, which I don't know the specifics of in terms of exactly where it came from or what it does, but there's been a lot of back and forth between Governor Rick Scott and Senator Bill Nelson over sort of who's to blame for this outgrowth, which has the potential to pollute a lot of Florida's beaches, which are very important not just for tourism, but for the fishing industry, which is very important to the state. So I think if there's one environmental issue that could impact a Senate race, it would be in Florida.
So going a little more local, the Maryland gubernatorial race, what do you think is going on?
So that's one of the really interesting ones. I think both Republican Governor Larry Hogan in Maryland, as well as Charlie Baker up in Massachusetts, are two Republicans who are up for re-election in states that Hillary Clinton won very handily. They're very blue states, but both seem to be in a pretty good position to win re-election. In Maryland, Larry Hogan is running against Ben Jealous. He's the former president of the NAACP and has embraced a number of policies that are a little to the left of the rest of the Democratic Party on things like health care. And I think that has worked in Governor Hogan's favor. I think there have been a couple of polls that have shown him up by double digits between 15 and 20 points, which is pretty insurmountable at this stage. Now, when it comes to the final results, will Governor Hogan still win by 15 or 20 points? That seems unlikely, especially if there's a lot of turnout, but there's not a lot of competitive congressional races in Maryland that would cause Democrats to say, this is my chance to put a check on President Trump. And so therefore, you're not going to see, I think, this big wave of people who will then vote for Ben Jealous as a secondary to that. One thing that Ben Jealous has done is tried to tie Governor Hogan to President Trump as a way to gin up sort of national attention on the race. But I do think Governor Hogan has done a nice job of pointing out the economy is doing well in Maryland and painting himself as a bipartisan figure in contrast to the polarization that we're seeing in Washington.
Right, right.
And Governors Baker and Hogan are two of the most popular governors, Republican governors in blue states, largely blue states.
That's right. Not just the most popular Republican governors, but the most popular governors in the whole country, which is pretty remarkable.
Yes.
Yeah, they're pretty popular across the board. Okay, well, thank you, Zach, for your time. And, you know, we'll see what transpires between now and then. We have 3 weeks to go, and I think we would like to invite you also right after the midterms, you know, to maybe analyze some of the races that we talked about and see, you know, what happened, and then kind of compare notes pre and post midterms.
Sounds great.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Zach. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Between the Beltways, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Find it each month on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.aois21.com. Keep up with the news between episodes on our Facebook at facebook.com/BTBeltways, on Twitter at BTBeltways, and on our WordPress blog, BetweenTheBeltways.wordpress.com.
Copyright 2018 AOS 21 Media LLC. All rights reserved. AOS 21 Media. What do you want your story to be?